Russia's plan to put nuclear weapons in Belarus has Europe on edge.
It's one of Russia's most pronounced nuclear signals since the beginning of its invasion of Ukraine 13 months ago. And Ukraine's foreign ministry on Sunday called for an extraordinary meeting of the UN Security Council.
Plus, a look at the latest developments from the front lines in Ukraine's east.
This would provide Russian forces much better chances and positions to actually intensify the shelling on such cities as Slovyansk and Kramatorsk.
And later in the program, a look at Russian athletes and international competition. Today is Monday, March 27th. From the Voice of America in Washington, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish. NATO on Sunday criticized Vladimir Putin for what it called his dangerous and irresponsible nuclear rhetoric. This one day after the Russian president said he planned to put tactical nuclear weapons in Belarus. Reuters' Rachel Faber has this report.
NATO on Sunday criticized Vladimir Putin for what it called his dangerous and irresponsible nuclear rhetoric. This comes after the Russian president said Saturday he would station tactical nuclear weapons in Belarus, Ukraine's neighbor. Putin likened it to the U.S. stationing its weapons in Europe while insisting that Russia would not violate its nuclear non-proliferation promises. A NATO spokesperson said in emailed comments to Reuters on Sunday that Russia has consistently broken its arms control commitments. It's one of Russia's most pronounced nuclear signals since the beginning of its invasion of Ukraine 13 months ago. And Ukraine's foreign ministry on Sunday called for an extraordinary meeting of the UN Security Council and for the international community to take decisive measures to prevent Russia's use of nuclear weapons. Washington played down concerns. White House National Security Council spokesman John Kirby said the U.S. had seen no sign that Putin had moved any nuclear weapons.
I can tell you that we've seen nothing that would indicate Mr. Putin is preparing to use tactical nuclear weapons in any way whatsoever in Ukraine. And I can also tell you that we haven't seen anything that would cause us to change our own strategic nuclear deterrent posture.
Meanwhile, Ukrainian forces have managed to blunt Russia's offensive in and around the embattled eastern city of Bakhmut, the scene of brutal fighting in the last few months. Ukraine's general staff said on Sunday that Ukrainian forces had repelled 85 Russian attacks over the past 24 hours in several parts of the Eastern Front, including Bakhmut. Separately, Britain's defense ministry said the months-long Russian assault on the city had stalled, mainly as a result of heavy troop losses. Reuters could not immediately verify the battlefield reports.
Reuters' Rachel Faber reporting for us today. What would having Russian tactical nuclear weapons in Belarus mean for the war? What would it mean for Europe and NATO? For more context on the situation, I'm joined by Jeff Selden, VOA's national security correspondent. One of the things Putin said was that, well, the U.S. does this. They keep nuclear weapons all over Europe. Right. And he's right. We do. NATO said that's not really a fair comparison. Why?
Well, part of the rationale here is that Russia for a long time had bragged about how it did not deploy its nuclear warheads outside of Russia. So we're looking at a very marked change in terms of Putin's policy, in terms of how it's using nuclear weapons. This also comes after lots of saber rattling by Vladimir Putin, other Russian officials about willingness. And if you look at the Russian media landscape, some of the more right-wing Russian hosts and presenters on Russian media have been talking about how Russia would be justified to use nuclear weapons if it's pushed to the edge. So that's part of the context here. Also, Russia has been withdrawing and pulling back from international arms treaties, most recently the START treaty. And while it says it's still complying in terms of the limitations on nuclear warheads, as far as the numbers, it hasn't been sharing information as required. The U.S. still is. So there's a bigger background here that's causing additional concern. Yes, the U.S. has nuclear warheads based overseas in a number of countries, Belgium, Turkey, the Netherlands, some others as well. That's been the case. This is a change, and therefore, because it's a change in the context of a war that Russia is waging and not winning against Ukraine, it presents additional concerns.
If you take a look at a map of the fighting in Ukraine, most of the fighting is towards the south and to the east. Belarus is north of Ukraine. Militarily, why would the Russians move tactical nuclear weapons there?
It's a threat. And part of the way that Russia seems to be using, if you talk to analysts, Russia has been using its nuclear arsenal isn't so much to actually deploy it, which it hasn't, but to threaten the use of nuclear weapons, to kind of hold back the West, try to push back against the West and its support for Ukraine. The West has become increasingly supportive and willing to give Ukraine more and more weaponry as this war has dragged on and as it sees a need and an opportunity to push Russia back and support an ally in Ukraine and have Ukraine achieve victory. So it's another way that Russia can present a threat. Whether or not it'll work remains to be seen. And of course, there's always a chance that at some point, something in the calculus will change. And U.S. officials, intelligence officials, military officials have said they haven't seen this yet, but there's always a chance something in Putin's thinking could change and he'll decide to actually deploy a tactical nuclear weapon. And again, looking at the map, if he has some in Belarus, there are targets, there are areas he might want to hit from Belarus. That's more convenient than if he had to launch it from Russia further away. And it doesn't necessarily mean that he's planning on targeting something in Ukraine. It could be, but he could have Western targets in mind as well, which would change the face of this war dramatically and drastically. But it's something that military planners, intelligence officials have to take into account.
Jeff Selden is VOA's national security correspondent. Jeff, thanks for your time. Thanks for your analysis today.
Anytime.
Heavy fighting in Ukraine's east and missile attacks in the city of Slovyansk. For a look at the latest military developments, I'm joined by our reporter in Kyiv, Anna Chernikova.
The situation at the front line in Ukraine, particularly at the eastern front line, which is one of the hottest spots at this point of time, maybe even the hottest right now, remains very, very tough. So here we're talking about Donetsk region and fightings which are happening around the city of Bakhmut and also in the area. These are different cities, including the city of Avdiivka. So this probably Avdiivka direction and Bakhmut direction are the hottest at this point. What we know from the Ukrainian military officials, from the general staff particularly, that situation remains very tough. However, over the weekend, it was information that Ukrainian forces managed to stabilize certain parts of the front line. And for the moment, the city of Bakhmut, well, it remains partially under Ukrainian, partially under Russian control. And it's really, for us at this point, it's difficult to say which parts exactly are under which control. But anyways, we have confirmation that Ukrainian forces remain at their positions and remain at their defense positions. And of course, Russian forces continue their assault and continue their tries to advance. Also, we are hearing that that commander of the Ukrainian ground forces, Alexander Sirsky, was again visiting the area of this fierce fighting in the eastern part of the country at the eastern front line, and he said that basically the fightings at the moment are at their most intensive point. So basically, according to him, situation is stably difficult. So what we're also hearing is that actually the access to the city of Avdiivka has been denied to journalists and to the civilians due to the situation with the fightings there. So for the moment, there is a risk, a very high risk, that the city could be surrounded. Similar situation was with Bakhmut, and it didn't happen to Bakhmut, but still access to Bakhmut is currently remaining very strict, and mostly for the military. So similar actions are taking towards Avdiivka, and no volunteers, no journalists are allowed to enter the city.
And this morning here in Washington, we've been reading about what's happening in Slovensk. Can you fill us in?
Yes. So today, basically, it was another very bad shelling of one of the big cities in the Donetsk region. This time, it's the city of Slovensk. Slovensk is located just 30 kilometers away from the city of Izum, which is already Kharkiv region. So it's basically a border between Donetsk and Kharkiv region. And according to the local authorities and also President Zelensky reported the news that it was a missile strike at the city center, and local authorities confirmed that Russian forces attacked the central part of the city with two missiles, C-300 missiles. For the moment, we know about one person killed and 25 wounded. The damages are of the private sector, the damages are of the civilian buildings, and a lot of cars also have been destroyed and are on fire due to this attack. What is important to mention that the city of Slovensk is, let's put it this way, one of the main rotation points, and it's kind of it's very central in terms of the for people who are trying to evacuate from the frontline areas deeper to the controlled territory of Ukraine. So there are a lot of people there, and of course it's quite quite a bad attack that we experienced today.
And the fighting there is still going on.
Around, yes. So the city of Slovensk is under the shelling, but no fightings are happening, well, at the outskirts, because fightings are happening next to Bakhmut, which is farther away. But basically, well, we can put it this way, that if the city of Bakhmut would be under Russian control, this would provide Russian forces much more chances and much better chances and positions to actually intensify the shelling on such cities as Slovensk and Kramatorsk.
Okay, we'll leave it there for today. Anna Chernikova in Kyiv. Anna, as always, thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Steve.
According to Ukrainian officials, more than 16,000 Ukrainian children have been forcibly deported to Russia or Russian-controlled Ukrainian territories. As of March 24th, only 324 had been returned, including Oleana Dudnik's son, Andriy. Lyesa Bakalets has more on one mother's ordeal.
This is very risky. These parents, these guardians are not 100% certain to return with their child.
According to Ukrainian officials, more than 16,000 Ukrainian children have been forcibly deported to Russia or Russian-controlled Ukrainian territories.
We received the appropriate number of applications for that number of children. These applications sometimes come from parents, other relatives, local authorities, or simply from eyewitnesses who have information about the fact of deportation or forced transfer of a child.
Russian authorities don't deny they take children out of Ukrainian territories, but they don't call it deportation. Russia's permanent representative to the UN, Vasily Nebenzia, said this was done to protect children from the danger of military operations. Regardless, the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for Russian President Vladimir Putin, accusing him for a personal responsibility for the unlawful deportation and transfer of children from Ukraine. Magdalena Gavin, director of the Pilecki Institute, a Polish government-funded group dedicated in part to studying totalitarian regimes, thought the decision was crucial.
This case is particularly important because it's a part of crimes against humanity. So this is the different degree, is a higher degree of war crimes.
Olena Dudnik managed to take her son back from Moscow, and Ukrainian volunteers helped them find temporary protection. But Ukrainian officials say so far fewer than 400 children like Andriy have returned. Lesya Bakalets for VOA News.
Last week, World Athletics, the governing body of track and field, the largest sport at the Olympic Games, voted to end its 8-year ban of the Russian Athletics Federation. but the country's athletes will remain excluded from international competition. VOA's Lori London spoke with World Athletics President Seb Coe on the decisions.
First off, why end the ban?
We initially suspended the Russian Federation back in 2015, November of 2015. And we did so because of the egregious attack on the integrity of our sport through state-sponsored doping. And that wasn't just a conclusion we drew. That is also the conclusion that the World Anti-Doping Agency concluded and various other agencies that looked into the issue. We created a task force. The task force was chaired independently, but on the strictest interpretation of the roadmap for reinstatement that we created together with the Russian Federation, it was an agreed approach. The task force did conclude that the journey had been met. The cultural shift, the control of testing, the confidence that we, to the best of our ability, had a new system in place and with some fairly firm conditions attached to their reintroduction. However, once that decision was made, there was another decision that we had to address, and that was the continued exclusion of Russian and Belarusian athletes and officials that we took this time last year because of the illegal invasion of a sovereign state. And the council concluded, after some debate and discussion, that nothing had altered in principle. In fact, arguably, it had got worse since the decision to suspend both Belarusian athletes and officials and Russian athletes and officials from our world championships. So the exclusion was extended.
I understand that more than 100 athletes have actually been a part of the casualties of this war beyond all the thousands of other people that have been killed.
Yes, I'm sadly have to report that that total at the moment stands at around about 185. We're still sadly still counting. So the judgment was made that while you have Ukrainian athletes that are at such a big disadvantage, the male team particularly, because most of them are actually fighting for their country. I sat in silence with a girl not that long ago in the Ukrainian team who hours beforehand had lost a mother in a missile attack on her home. So I'm afraid from a personal point of view, and I think collectively from the council, this was not the dance we were prepared to sit out.
What needs to happen, as far as you're concerned, before any reinstatement could be considered?
That, I think, is a really important and key question, if I may say so. And I don't have an immediate or even an instinctive answer. I know probably, in fairness, my instinctive answer would be to say that when Russia is actually out of Ukraine, but I have to be realistic about these matters. And that's why we've also created a working group that will be, again, independently chaired, simply to look at what does need to happen in order to lift the exclusion on international athletes from Russia and Belarus and their team officials from competing in our world championships and by implication, the Olympic Games as well. So that working group will come together pretty quickly. But for the foreseeable future, the exclusion pertains to our world championships this year. And of course, our next world championships this summer in Hungary.
You must have some mixed emotion that this is also punishing athletes in Russia that really have no say in what its leaders are doing.
I do. I think anybody that's taken this decision, or many on my council that voted to support the exclusion, are Olympic champions. They're world record holders. So this was not a decision that was taken lightly. I think the council concluded, and I certainly take the view, that this is not the time, I'm afraid, any longer for philosophical discussions about the primacy, independence, flexibility of our international federations, or the rights of athletes to compete at any cost. I'm afraid the boat left that harbour some time ago. And yes, it will probably create some precedents going forward, but I'm afraid we and the council made the judgment there isn't a threshold of morality here. This is an unacceptable situation, and it digs deep into the integrity of those athletes who want to compete, free from the fear and the damage to their careers in Ukraine.
Russia reacted to the decision by condemning this as basically being a politicized restriction. Do you have any response to that?
My response is a very simple one, that you can define it in whichever way you want. This was absolutely about the integrity of competition and the ability of a country to field a team at a time where it is almost impossible to have the strongest team out there. We made a judgment that it was just inconsistent to be giving the full panoply of rights and responsibilities to Russian and Belarusian athletes, while Ukrainian athletes, the male team in large part, are fighting for the defense of their country. And a large part of the federation and coaches that are working with athletes are sheltering in bunkers. I'm sorry, that's just the way we saw it. And I don't think we felt, I certainly didn't feel, that we could be neutral on that.
VOA's Laurie London speaking with Seb Coe, head of World Athletics. Now, a poll of global attitudes regarding Russia's war on Ukraine suggests the West has regained its unity and sense of purpose following the invasion. The survey, conducted in 15 countries in December and January, shows markedly different attitudes in non-Western nations, as Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
Most Western leaders have rallied behind Ukraine in the face of Russia's invasion, and they have warned of the threat posed by Moscow. The poll by the European Council on Foreign Relations suggests citizens in these countries largely agree. Susie Dennison is a co-author of the report.
There is a general agreement with the idea that Ukraine needs to regain all of its territory. And that has grown in the European countries that we looked at since we asked a similar question last summer.
The report says three factors have driven Western unity: Ukrainian successes on the battlefield, the way the war has united the political left and right, and the perceived return of a strong West led by the US. Europeans also feel they have weathered a difficult winter, despite high energy prices caused by Russia's invasion. Again, Susie Dennison.
We can sustain economically the position that we're taking against Russia, and that we need to do so because of the nature of the war that Russia is fighting, that it threatens the fundamental rules on which the international order is based.
As Russia tries to take more territory in a spring offensive, the report authors say Western leaders should exploit the public support for arming Ukraine. Again, Susie Dennison.
Military aid and support in dealing with that is needed now, because if it starts to look like this is not something that that the Ukrainians can push back against, then we could see the support among Europeans begin to dissipate.
The same poll conducted in China, India and Turkey gave very different answers. In these countries, majorities favoured a quick end to the war, even if Ukraine has to concede territory. Again, Susie Dennison.
You have strong majorities that say Russia is either an ally or a necessary partner. They see a world of multipolarity in which they are going to have to form pragmatic, relatively interest-based alliances.
Most respondents in Europe and America expect a bipolar world dominated by the US and China. However, a majority of citizens in non-Western countries expect a fragmented global order, with several competing powers making up a multipolar world. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
And that'll do it for us today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day. Visit us online at voanews.com and on social media. Be sure to follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.